This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We find out about American history through our teachers, textbooks, films, the like. And on the other hand, on our personal stories, and personal histories do come from stories. Maybe they're told around the dinner table. But what if those accounts don't fit who you feel you truly are? What if pieces of your personal history are missing from those stories? For writer and environmental scientist Laurette Savoy, the American landscape itself holds the key to her personal narrative. She's a woman of mixed heritage, and her work explores the intersection of natural and cultural histories. Laurette Savoy is a participant in the Anthropocene Project at Duke University that's calling for a shift in academic thinking in this, the Anthropocene epoch. She's a professor of environmental studies and geology at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Her book is called Trace: Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. Laurette, welcome to the State. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This book is deeply personal, but it's also a story about landscape and about topography. What got you thinking about this particular connection, this personal connection to the land?
Frank, I think earth grounds everything that we are. You could think of it in terms of the events of our lives take place. And those places have great meaning. And if I may, I can say a little bit about why I came to this book. And it's really based on struggles that I've had to face questions that haunted me since childhood. Questions like, if each of our lives is an instant, like a camera shutter that opens and closes, what can we make of our place in the world for that instant? And then over time, over space, what do generations of instants mean? And the struggle to answer that, realizing that earth grounds all, became a historical inquiry, but also a journey across the continent in time to try to understand how this country's still unfolding history has marked the land, but also has marked American society and myself as a person.
And the various societies who have lived here and will in the future. And you represent many of those societies. You're African American, Euro-American, and Native American. How much of that and your contemplation of those ethnic identities informs this book?
It informs it from the very beginning. I grew up as a child not knowing anything of my past, not knowing who we were, where we came from, other than my parents living in this city, grandparents living in that city. But having a sense of generational or familial relationship to North America, I had no idea. And my parents never told me, not at all. My mother, if you saw her, she passed away. My mother was a dark-skinned woman, rich dark skin with dark eyes. My father, very light-skinned man, blue eyes, graying golden hair. And as a little child, I never knew race. I'd never understood it. My family looked as diverse as the land itself. And as a child, I believed that we came from the land. And it was only later that I realized that ancestors, as you said, came from Africa and were here on this continent during the colonial period, as well as the colonizers from Europe and peoples indigenous to this land. And so I needed to understand or to try to understand what this ancestry meant, but also why I didn't know, why the stories were silenced. But I also knew that this went beyond just an individual story. A story of silencing and as erasure is something that touches many people in this country.
When did you become curious about it? I mean, what were your parents saying about your background?
Nothing.
Did you ask?
And I did ask.
Yeah.
I remember my mother asking me, why do you want to know? And I think that perhaps I realized, even very young, that there was a border there, that by asking I was overstepping, not knowing what that was, but fearing that maybe this is something I shouldn't be asking now. But still the question was there. I wanted to know. So as a child, I developed my own self-theory of where I came from. And at this point, we lived in Southern California, and it was a place defined by light. And it was the clarity of the light, the depth and its brilliance that really touched me. And my bedroom faced west. And one of my joys was being on the the porch in the afternoon, watching the late day sun set and the slant light glowing, illuminating the land around me. And it was then, at the age of 5, I knew, as a child can know, that the sun made my skin and colored my skin just as it colored the land in that golden light. And if I looked at my arm, I believed that sky flowed in my veins. So at the age of 5, I believed I had a familial link with the land. I thought that's where we came from. And if anyone at that time had asked me what the word colored meant, I'm sure that's how I would have responded. It was only later that I learned that colored had a different meaning.
Well, what happened in that moment? I mean, talk about that that moment, and I don't know if it's a particular moment, but as you begin to realize that colored has a very different connotation and definition among the people who you were living around.
Well, we moved back to Washington, D.C. I say back because that was my father's generational home, and this was the end of the 1960s. So it was a time of great conflict and upset. And I remember I was 7 going on 8, second grade. A classmate asked me if I was colored. But the way in which he said colored was so ugly, so emptying, so degrading, as if you wouldn't want to touch that word with a 10-foot pole. And it was in that year that I was first spat upon as a child. And that was the year I was called nigger for the first time. And then I realized that I could be hated simply by what I looked like, not because who I was, because no one wanted to even find that out. It's as if that was territory that couldn't be entered.
By then, had you realized that this was something you couldn't take home and talk about, or did you?
Oh, I did. Yeah. I remember that day. That day that my classmate was Bobby Kane. And he came up and asked me. We were right by the swings. And I asked my teacher. This was a Catholic school, and she was a nun, Sister Mary Richard Ann. And she couldn't answer. And then I went home and I asked my parents. And it was at that point that I understood or began to understand what racial difference meant. And it was extremely painful.
What did that do to the narrative that you'd already created, the story about yourself as having been created by the earth, by the sky, by the sun?
I couldn't let it go because that narrative was a sense of belonging. It gave me that. It was a sense of that I am a worthy, worthwhile human being. So what I wanted more than anything was for us to move back to California. Because for me, that was the place before race, even though it never was a place before race. I mean, the Watts riots had happened there years before. But I didn't know that. For me, that was a time of innocence and a time when I could feel part of what was around me and not in danger, not vulnerable. But in Washington, D.C., I began to understand what vulnerability could be.
So tell us more about then the organization of this book and how this book is in some ways your journey, your meditation on those very questions.
I begin the book with chapters that take me back to places I understood or knew as a child. These are journeys that I made years ago. And it was in these places that I began to ask the questions about origins, to piece together. And I realized that in order to understand my origins, it was important to understand those of those who preceded me within my family, but of other Americans or other people who have lived on this continent. And so the historical inquiry was part of the personal journey. Understanding how other experiences of place had happened in this country. And so each chapter, I like to think of it, if you can imagine a wagon wheel, where each chapter beginning along the perimeter, the edge of the wheel, at a different place or with a different question, and then coming in to a center of understanding. And the places took me from the Grand Canyon and the San Andreas Fault Zone to a South Carolina plantation, from an island in Lake Superior to Indian Territory in Oklahoma, and the black towns that were established there both before and after the Civil War. The journeys and the inquiry took me to the U.S.-Mexico border and how it began, as well as how the nation's capital was established. And journeys took me to national parks, to burial grounds, but also to the origin of names that the American landscape wears.
Can I ask you to read from the book?
Oh, I'd be glad to. I think I'll read a brief section, just one paragraph from a chapter on what's in a name and the origin of names on the land. And I should just preface this by saying that as a child, one of the games that I would play would be singing the names of places out loud. And I believed, again, this is around 5 years old, that by singing the names, I could travel to them. And as an adult, I did travel to many of them, but I also wanted to know how they began. Why are the names on the land? So I hope this will give you a sense of the beginning. Once the continent wore no names, having no need for them, the languages of water, ice, and wind prevailed. Yet one can say Oklahoma or Yellowstone or Badlands without thinking, so embedded are they in American vocabulary. It may be a commonplace to consider place names or toponyms as givens, distinguishing one piece of terrain from another. To think this, though, is to see a reflecting surface and not what lies beneath.
Laura Savoy reading from Trace, Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. You know, your concept of belonging to the space, belonging to place, because of a palpable sensation that it gives you, varies so much from what culture gives us, right? The cultural connection to a place is the story we tell about the place. So you can find Americans who live in Texas and Arizona, for instance, who want Mexican Americans to leave their country and are shocked to find out that those families have been living in Arizona and Texas longer than those European, those families from other parts of Europe. So the sense of ownership, it's ours, it's our America, comes from a story and not any real sense of having been on the land for any longer. That's, as I say, that people are shocked to find out that those people who speak Spanish have been there longer than you. What do you make of that? What do you make of that? How we feel connected and the fact that telling the story, and of course it gets told by the victors, so the people who shot the natives off this land and took it from them get to tell the story about what America really is, and the people whose land was stolen from them and the people who did the work to finance what is now the United States of America and were not paid don't get to tell that story.
I think I want to push back a little because I think they do tell stories, and the stories just are not heard or listened to by those who have a vested interest in keeping another narrative alive. And I think it might be worth considering the ability to have the power of the story that gets heard as a form of property ownership, and that those who had the power to dispossess, to force people to work on the land. And not only in the past, but even today, if you can think of people who work as quote-unquote migrant laborers or those who are working as tenants who do not control the land, yet still have a deep lifelong investment in the land. They may be the ones who have the soil most embedded in their fingers, yet do not have the ability to say, I own this. But they do own that relationship, and they do own the stories that they tell. So there's not a single story. There are many stories, and it's recognizing that multiplicity and not giving priority or privilege to one set of stories that, because they are telling of ownership, they need to erase or ignore the others.
So owning the narrative and owning the land are, at least in terms of the dominant narrative, so much of our politics is now governed by assumptions about our relationship with the land and who is the our and who is the we whenever these assumptions are proffered and again, acted on politically. You know, what does it take to get those alternative narratives heard and into what I think ultimately should be the political marketplace, right? I mean, that's the point of them in some ways.
That's a great question. I think it's also admitting that perhaps what you've been taught or what anyone has been taught as being the way in which this American continent was settled and has come to be is not necessarily the only way, and that in order for a story to become dominant, a told story, a story of any group, I think they need to understand, or anyone needs to understand, that if you think of a story as a possession, what you remember then is what you want to be remembered as. It's what you want to think is how you came to be. And this, the deep investment of having a story this way, that eliminates any contrary notion, that eliminates any difficulty, that makes it clean, that makes it celebratory, like hurrah, and the hurrah is only it. In order to do that, you must erase, you must silence. And I think what's required is an honest admission that that took place generation after generation. And that's hard to do. A lot of people, when you ask, if you ask them the question of what is history, they will say that history is really just what happened, the events that happen. But really, the history that we learn are the stories that are told about what happened. And those stories, in many ways, are so limiting and narrowing. And it's recognizing that. I think that's the first step.
In writing this book, do you think you have reached a bigger truth about our history and your own personal history?
I have, and I would say that it's not an end. I think it's the beginning of a process and realizing that I need to continue and continue. But I think one of the key elements that I've been able to take from this project is to recognize that to live in this continent, to live on it, whether or not you are a recent immigrant or a member of a group who has lived here for generations, and whether or not you're a colonizer or the descendant of those who were enslaved by colonizers, it's understanding that to live in this country means that you've been marked by this history, a history that's still unfolding, it's still ongoing, and that to understand how those marks touch you as an individual is something that perhaps many of us shared. And so I think that that realization, that understanding is what's really important. And it's what I've come to begin to understand. And so when you asked me earlier about being told about where I came from, I wasn't told then, but I'm learning now.
Laura Tsavoy, participant in the Anthropocene Project at Duke University. And that is calling for a big shift in the way the Academy thinks about the way we live on this planet and its own work in cultural and intellectual production, looking at the Anthropocene epic. Laura is a professor of environmental studies and geology at Mount Holyoke College. Her book is called Trace: Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. Laura, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank. I really enjoyed it.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we talk to an Oscar-nominated director from North Carolina about his nomination and his short film, My Nephew Emmett. Stay with us.